Sassy Jack Stitchery is sponsoring this week's show with Irish fiber and textile artist Sharon Wells. Kim and the folks at Sassy Jack's are starting to move inventory from Kim's basement to the new store, and it's looking like the long-awaited grand opening will happen in early 2023. In the meantime, be sure to check out sassyjackstitchery.com for the full collection of sassafras samplers charts. Kim and company are also now carrying the beautiful cottage garden threads, new designs from Ink Circles, and are restarting the Cosmo Thread Club. When you're doing your holiday shopping, a great gift for your stitching friends is a Sassy Jack's gift certificate. Make Sassy Jack Stitchery your local needlework store by visiting the website at sassyjackstitchery.com. And now let's enjoy our conversation with the extremely talented Irish artist, Sharon Wells. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Ireland, Sharon Wells. Sharon, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, this is going to be fun because we get to learn about needle felting and dyeing wool and...
Yes. and different types of wool. That was just fascinating watching your video, and you talked about your different wool types.
Yes.
And
well, that's a rabbit hole. Once you start dealing with different types of wool, so felting is very, very different from it's different from spinning and from knitting and crochet, in that the fibers that we use for felting don't have to be a quality that you can wear, or you know, that you use next to your skin, or you know, they can be the worst bits, even they can be matted, you know. So because I specialize in doing pictures, I really found it hard to get textural fibers that would mimic the landscape and mimic features in the landscape. So, you know, for example, grasses or bogland, which we have in Ireland a lot, and the sea and things like that. So I started looking at different types of wool. And so I started putting certain things, like you could always use Jacob's wool because it's got three different colors in it. You could use that for stone walls. You know, you can use any wool really for clouds, and also for the sea. You can get beautiful textural bits, and you don't need to prepare it that much. You just need to wash it, remove the lanolin, and then you can use it straight away. You can either needle felt it or wet felt it, you know. So that's the rabbit hole of using different wool fibers. And also, because there are a lot of sheep farmers in Ireland, and in the last few years they have started breeding sort of different breeds, you know, sort of rare breeds. And so we have access to a load of different types of wool that we wouldn't have had before. Like the most common one would be the mountain sheep that we have in County Kerry, where I'm from originally. And that's a coarse wool, almost like hair. And that's not good for clothing. So
okay,
a lot of that
Sharon,
would be dumped.
Sharon, let's stop right there. Okay. Just so people know, what Sharon does is she creates beautiful landscapes with wool using felting techniques. And she collects the wool and dyes it and uses all various techniques to create these landscape, really wool paintings, if you will.
That's it.
Yeah. So, all right. So let's address the wool thing, because I'm most curious about that. So you collect the wool from Irish shepherders
farms, yeah, sheep farmers.
Sheep farmers. Yeah. And so all right, so tell us about that. I mean, the various kinds of sheep, and you're looking, the different wool gives you different effects.
Yeah, exactly. So originally I would have been sort of just using the wool that I could get my hands on locally. But because I'm living in County Wicklow and my parents are in Kerry and I'm from Kerry, I would travel there. So I had like two good counties of sheep farmers to actually source wool from. So it was quite easy to get wool given to me because they were just dumping it anyway, because there's no value of wool in Ireland. So they either burn it or bury it. So that's a big problem.
Whoa, back up.
Yeah, I know. I was like, my eyes are getting big. And I'm like, what? They're burying it or burning it?
They're burying it and burning it because at this stage, the farmers only receive like €2.50, possibly, or even less for a fleece. And the fleece has to be in good quality. And then the fleece is taken by a wool merchant and then it's exported to India and China and places like that. That's the good stuff. The bad stuff, which when I mean bad stuff, I mean it's just been sheared and it's quite dirty because the sheep in Ireland have been bred for meat in the last 50, 60, 70 years. Before that, I mean, you know about the Aran sweaters and everything. Wool was a huge industry for Ireland, absolutely massive industry. But with cotton and alternatives and synthetics and everything, it really killed off the wool industry in Ireland. So the farmers had no option. They had to just get rid of it somewhere. There is nowhere. So they bury it and they compost it or they burn it. And so you would have, something like a farmer might have 500 sheep with nowhere to put that wool. Sell some of it possibly, but the majority of it was just being left. So you can, in this day and age, you can actually go to a farmer and say, can I have some of your wool? And most of the time they will just say to you, take as much as you want, you know. Wow. So that was kind of handy. So I was in touch.
That is kind of handy, yes, I'll say.
Very handy. For someone like me who doesn't need a huge, huge quantity, but it makes a huge difference to me because they were giving it to me for free. Now I would give them a present or I'd pay them something. I kind of insisted, you know, but they would say, take it away. We're just going to burn it or dump it anyway. So I could come back with 5 or 6 kilos of wool, which I could pick myself from the big bags that they have. They have ton bags of wool sitting there, and I could go into the ton bags, pull out the cleanest stuff and take it away with me. You know, it's not like somebody gave me a fleece that they picked necessarily and that I had to really go through and take all the dirty bits off. That happens as well. So usually I tell people, if people offer you wool, say, can I go pick it up myself? And so you don't need to take all the dirty bits from the back end. Yeah. You know, you can just pull the fleece apart and take the best of it. And then there's less washing and there's less processing. I mean, you don't really want to be dealing with something that's the back end of a sheep.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, I mean, we're textile artists. We actually want to just use the wool. We don't want to spend hours and hours cleaning it. So there was a few places that I knew. My cousin still lives in Kerry and she has sheep and she knows people with sheep. So she'd get me odd types. Like Zwarbles is a black sheep or it's a brown sheep. Jacobs, I said, is Jacobs got 3 different colours in it. So that's amazing if you can get a fleece with Jacobs wool. Wensleydale was mostly in the UK and we didn't really have access to it here, but we have breeders now breeding sheep with Wensleydale and loads of different types. So there's over 1,000 different types of sheep in probably in the world. I'm not sure I could be saying that wrong, but in the UK, because they're our neighbours, they have tons of different types, whereas we don't. Because they have a stronger wool industry. They also have woolen mills. They have woolen mills and wool processing mills. So they wash the wool there in big, huge processing plants. We don't have that in Ireland. We don't have anywhere to commercially wash the wool. So when you get the wool, you wash it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
you know. So that's what I would do. I get the wool and I wash it myself.
Okay, so let's back up here a little bit. So then, literally for your art, you have all the raw material you want just by simply making the effort of going to collect it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then how many? So then each different breed or species or whatever it is, variety of sheep then provides a different kind of wool, and so then that gives you options in terms of your art.
Exactly. So, and also there's a new Facebook group called Irish Sheep Discussion, and I joined that Facebook group, and on it is a whole, there's all the sheep farmers, and they will actually advertise their wool. They'll say, I've got 5 bags of Wensleydale, does anybody want some? So you can buy it directly from the farmers that way as well, if you don't know any farmers yourself. So that's handy for me, because sometimes, as I was saying, you need the different types. So Wensleydale's full of curls. That's like gold dust to get hold of some of that. And there's a few others, there's a little cuddly little sheep, and they look like teddy bears, and they're called Valet sheep. And they have the wool on their fleeces is so shiny that when you dye it, it has a glint off of it, you know. So this, you can use that for putting into the sea, or, you know, there's a few that you kind of have to work with them for a bit to kind of go, oh, I know what that's going to do. But then some have short fibers and some have longer fibers. So needle felting, it's easier to needle felt short fibers than long fibers. So there's some of it you can use for making needle felted toys. So you can card the stuff, you can wash it and you can card it. And then you have it as the core wool, which loads of people use to create needle felted objects. So I have farmers supplying me, but like just in the last couple of years, I have some from County Cork, Donegal, Dublin, Galway, Kerry, like several different parts of the country, because it's a different type of sheep. So there's Wensleydale from Donegal that I get, you know, there's Jacobs from County Wicklow, actually just down the road. And I get Lynn, and Blueface Leicester is one I get from County Dublin. So there's certain types that I know for my pictures I want to have. So I don't take everything I can get. I just go for the stuff that I know I can use, or I also sell it on, you know, because other people can't get hold of this stuff. So I wash it and dye it and sell it on as well. So that's kind of handy.
Yeah.
So are you said something, are people going back and breeding some of the heirloom sheep varieties again, or Ireland?
They are. That's a new thing that has come up in the last couple of years. The Galway sheep in the west coast of Ireland is one of the oldest known sheep breeds, and they have revised that. There's a big push on that up there. They have a lot of organization going on, and they're really pushing that type of wool. So they're trying to get that original wool back into the woolen mills again, because unfortunately, because the farmers stopped producing the wool, the sheep for wool, and it was just sheep for meat, a lot of the woolen mills were importing wool to use in Ireland. So you might have this debate. You might see it's starting now that the Aran sweater is extremely popular and extremely famous in Ireland. But sometimes you'll see websites that say it's handmade in Ireland, but the wool is, when you look at the labels, the wool is imported, which is totally nuts, because Ireland has a lot of sheep.
Right.
You know?
So, yeah, that's the part I'm struggling with. Okay, they're burning it and burying it, and then you're importing it to make sweaters. It's not...
You see, because we have no processing plant in Ireland yet. Now, I think that the tide is turning, you know, and people are starting to put pressure onto the government and things like that about saying all we want is one wool processing plant. Because if we had one in the country, we're not a big country, we could do with just one. Because otherwise, if I wanted, if I didn't want to hand wash all of my wool, I would have to send it to Yorkshire in England or Cornwall, you know. And right. Now that the UK have left the EU, import and export charges to and from Ireland are a bigger issue for us.
Yeah.
So I've found that people are looking for wool in Ireland now that they don't have to buy in from the UK. So that's kind of helped in a way. You know, they don't want to buy off some of the UK sites because it's just going to cost them a fortune in taxes and in postage. So with someone like me, if I'm supplying it, then they can just, you know, order it from me and get it there. In 2 or 3 days time, and there's only the cost of the local, you know, national post, you know, so
right.
it's kind of convenient for people, yeah. But it's a niche area, you know, it's not a big business, it's a niche right. area.
Right, right, but you know, just the change in the environment with the sheep herders or the sheep farmers going from wool that you manufactured into sweaters, then going to meat, and then maybe trying to go back to farming sheep for wool production again. But they need a way to process that wool. If not, it's not economically feasible, no. right?
No, no. And there's a delay, you know, because some of the mills in the UK, especially around the time of Brexit, I know some of the textile artists were sending wool there and they said there was a backlog of a year and a half. So, you know, that's not going to, no, you can't use a business, you know, that's not going to do you any good. So so that's what we need. And we also need to promote wool and all of its uses as well so that there's a market for it, because we could produce loads of wool and then there'd be nowhere to put it. So we have to start working on the products that you can use with wool. People are starting to use it for insulation. But again, there's nowhere to get it ready.
Yeah.
And some people are making it into pellets now, because in the EU, we have to stop cutting our turf bogs, because we would traditionally have cut peat bogs and we would have cut that to use as fuel.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's increasing the emissions, they want people to use less peat. So they need something as an alternative, because peat moss would be what people would use in their gardens. So they're trying, they need alternatives to that as well. So wool is a fantastic alternative because it's like a fertilizer.
Yeah.
And it holds water and it's, you know, it cools you and heats you at different times of the year. And I know for a fact in France that they put it around their vines. They put wool around their vines in the ground in the winter to keep the roots warm. So, I mean, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So we should all be doing things. Yeah.
Yeah. So you go and collect the wool, and then the video that Beth and I watched of you processing the wool and dyeing it was most fascinating. So that, did you have to teach yourself,
yeah.
or did someone show you how to do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, YouTube is probably the best university there is for crafters, you know, because you just go on and go, how do I wash wool out of, how do I wash lanolin out of wool? So I did have to learn, and I suppose asking a few people. Wool, I suppose, is my specialty, so not a lot of people there aren't a lot of people in Ireland doing the extent of what I'm doing with it, but there's a few in different parts of the country. So, you know, you can always email them and say, would you mind letting me know what you do? And, you know, you can always ask. But the thing that we used to use is power scour, unicorn scour, which is sold in the States. So a friend of mine, another textile artist, she would import it and we'd buy it off her. It's quite expensive, but it does a really, really good job. So the wool needs to be washed with what's called, and I might pronounce this wrong, a surfactant. So it's the same thing that you would use if you were washing your greasy pans. So it's not like washing, it's not like what you'd use to wash your clothes.
Yeah.
It's what you need to wash something with grease in it. So in America, I think they use Dawn soap, and some of them have that surfactant in them. So it removes the grease. So you have to soak the water in very, very hot, soak the wool in very, very hot water and put in something like that. The unicorn scouring liquid, or we have fairy liquid over here, they call it. So anything like that, that would be quite strong. So what happens is it rips the grease out of the wool, and the grease actually comes to the surface. So you can see it's like a milky substance coming up. So then you don't put it down your drain, because it's a really bad idea for so many reasons.
Yes.
So, you know, and I've learned that lesson the hard way in my shed. So,
yeah, I'll bet you were popular.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. And so I, if I ever do it, I have to make sure nobody's watching me. So what I do is I take the wool out and throw the water into my garden. Now, I have a big garden, so I'm able to put it into the plants and everything. And the plants love it. It's the perfect thing for plants because it's got all that fertilizer and everything in it. So so that's ideal. But for people who don't have that, it's tricky. So, you know, somebody living in an apartment or something is not going to be able to wash wool in that way, because they can't dispose of the water safely. So,
right.
So that's one of the things. And that's, you know, when you look at it on a larger scale and a commercial scale, any processing plant that opens has to be able to get rid of that water successfully. But I'm sure there's some way that it could be turned into a product which could be used for something else. There must be somewhere doing that already. So you have to do that a couple of times, because it doesn't all come out. And some sheep's wool has more lanolin in it than others. So you kind of get to know it after a while. You can kind of see that there's more in it, because the water is still kind of milky when you're washing it, when you're rinsing it. So if it's still milky, you know there's a good bit more lanolin in it. So maybe you'd want to go again and put the scouring liquid in again and go for it. So after that, then it's just a matter of letting it dry. You can dry it indoors, you can dry it wherever you like, you can hang it in a laundry bag, or, you know, in the summer it's kind of handy. I have a metal laundry tower thing, and it has shelves in it, and I just put the wool in there, and the wind and the sun dries it within a day or so, you know. So in some cases, after I've washed it, I might go straight to the dyeing, because there's no point drying it and then wetting it to dye it again.
Right.
So, you know.
When it comes to the lanolin, do you always just remove as much as you can, or because that prevents the dye from attaching to the fibers? So, or is that part of the art, in terms of if you don't remove as much, you can control how the dye works?
Well, that would be very advanced, I suppose, if you were trying to do that. If you were scientific, which I'm not, but you could. We see every sheep's wool, as I said, every breed has a different amount of lanolin, and then every sheep within the breed has a different amount, because you don't know how old your sheep is and how much lanolin is on the fleece. So it would be almost impossible to do it that way. And some sheep's wool actually takes dyes better than others. So I've used Suffolk. Somebody gave me Suffolk, and that takes dyes incredibly well. Whereas some of the others, like the Kerry Mountain sheep, it's a bit pale. You know, you could put both of the wools into the same dye pot, and one of them will come out a lot paler. So the uptake of dye is different, and it's not necessarily based on the amount of lanolin. It's just maybe to do with the fact that one sheep is more, the sheep's wool is more coarse than the others. So Suffolk is a very, very soft, very short kind of a lock. So it takes wool, takes dye very easily. Whereas some of the other ones with the long-haired sheep, they call them, it's more hairy than woolly.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't take the dye as well.
So the best thing is get as much lanolin out as you can and then go from there.
Yeah, as much. Exactly. And I mean, for felters, I suppose it depends on whether you're needle felting or wet felting. Because when you're wet felting, you want to get a lot of it out. When you're needle felting, it doesn't really matter on a picture. See, pictures are different to a lot of other things that you would make with felting, because you don't need to completely hard felt a picture, because you want it to be textural and you want parts of it to stand up. And well, I do the way I do, I don't do flat stuff. I build my pictures up, you know. So if something is matted and full of lanolin and something like that, and it's a white piece and I've just washed it and I haven't really bothered to take much, I can still use that because I can just needle felt that in the front and it looks like a massive wave, you know. So you kind of look at the pieces you've got and kind of say, well, yeah, I could actually use that the way it is, yeah. You know. So so that's kind of the that's the, I suppose, you're assessing your materials. And that's what I tell my students. I say, whatever materials you end up using, just look at them as if they are just materials. Like if somebody turns up with a ball of wool and go, oh, I don't know, I can't really do much with this ball of wool. You go, well, what you do with that ball of wool is you cut a piece off of it and you rip it apart, turn it back into fiber, brush it, or when you rip a ball of yarn apart, sometimes because it's plied, it has these curls in it. So I'm always telling them to gather loads of stuff together, but just take what you need, rip it apart. Just, you know, it's almost like you're in your head, you're looking at it going, that would be a grass, but I don't need that bit that's sticking off the end. So I'm just going to take this bit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
You're really picking and choosing your materials to a huge extent. You know, you're really, in the beginning, I was set out my colors in the very beginning. I set out my textures and my colors, and I'd really plan it for picture in the very, very, very beginning. And I would save things sometimes. If I dyed them, I'd save things and go, oh, that's kind of nice. It's got a bit of blue and white in it. That would be really nice now for a wave or something. So I actually take them and put them away somewhere and go, I'm going to use you later, you know. So some of it is accidental. You know, you just happen to get something, a nice result when you're, you know, dyeing something, or, you know, you do it on purpose.
Yeah.
And you can get grasses and colors and things like that. But it's usually a process of discovery, all of this. Because you don't know what's in a bag. You don't know what wool you're going to get some of the times. You do to a certain degree. You know it's a certain type. But you don't know exactly how curly it's going to be or how dirty it's going to be or, you know, how well it takes up the dye. And do you have the same dyes as you had last time? How much did you put in? You know, so it's all a bit. For anyone who is scientific, they would just hate the way I work, because it's just I just love playing with stuff. You know, wool is my passion, right? Really, I just go back to it all the time. Even if I do other crafts, you know, I always go back to wool, because you can just have so much fun with it.
It's so neat to hear you talk about that, because, you know, we think about an artist, a painter with their palette of paints, and then you have this palette of wool that
yes.
has a second layer of palette of how it's dyed. And yeah, you know, the art within the art within the art is really fun to hear about.
It's layered. It's literally layered, you know, because it's also the way you the way you use that wool will make a difference.
Yeah.
Because I can just take the lock and I can dye it and then I can needle felt it into place just like that. Or I can wet felt it and then I can cut pieces out of the wet felted bit and put it on. Or I could intermingle them all together, you know. So you're constantly sort of using loads of different processes, you know. I mean, wet felting and needle felting are quite rigid, but they're rigid processes, but what you can do with them is crazy. It's so broad, you know.
Can you do a brief because I think we'll have some listeners that don't know. Okay, so what do you mean by wet felting and what do you mean by needle felting?
Okay, well, the process of felting, as people know, is thousands of years old. And it's been found in China and Mongolia and all the Uzbekistans and Afghanistans and all the stands. And it's one of the oldest known textile processes. It was used to create tents for the nomads when their yurts. So they would use the wool and they would create huge pieces of felt by laying out the wool on some other fabric that they already had, like a mother. They have a mother felt. It's like a carpet. And then they lay out the wool on top of it, put a bit of soap on it, whatever they use for soap. It was probably ash or something. And then water, and soak the whole thing, roll it all up, tie it with ropes, and then ride a horse or an animal, like a camel, across the desert or wherever they were living, and create heat and friction. And then that creates the felting process. So everybody understands when they put their woolen jumper into the washing machine and it comes out 10 times smaller.
Right.
So that's what we've all done. So that's the process of felt. So you need fiber, you need heat, and you need agitation. And those three things will felt wool. So you can control that process. And we do it with the wet felting in a very controlled process, and that we lay out the wool in a controlled manner. And then we just squeeze a bit of hot water and proper soap on top of it. And then some people use netting. So there's a few different ways there. I use bubble wrap and I put the bubble wrap down on top of it. And I just put a little bit of soap and water on the top and then rub the fibers. Within seconds, the fibers will join together and create a solid piece of fabric. And the reason why they're doing that is because they have scales, and wool scales help the wool attract to another piece of wool. So they interlock. So when you're felting, you're interlocking wool fibers. So that's the wet felting process. And it's one of the most magical processes, because if you do it with students, they just cannot believe how one minute it's a layer of fiber, and the next minute you pick it up and go, look at this. This is a solid fabric. So it's fantastic for kids and people of all ages. Needle felting is a fairly modern process, in that it is a process that was used to make the green felt that you find on pool tables and snooker tables. So that green stuff that's there is created using a needle felting machine, which has thousands of felting needles in it. So some clever crafters saw this and went, hang on one second, could we not do this for a craft? And that developed. So I think that's only from the 70s. It's fairly new. And people started getting these needles. And the needles have barbs on them, so they produce agitation and friction and heat as well. So if you stab the needle in and out of fiber it will actually have the same effect as wet felting. So it binds the fibers together, they interlock, and you can create a solid piece. So the needle felting is a great addition to wet felting for me when I'm doing pictures, because I can wet felt my picture first, and then wet felting flattens everything quite a lot. So then you can put other bits and pieces on top, other bits of fibers and yarns and things, and then you can just use your needle and you can pinpoint the areas where you want to stick these in. So it's a bit like using, as you were saying, with it's like painting. It's a bit like using a fine brush. So you use your felting needle like a fine brush, and you can put in your different fibers and just tack them into place with your felting needle. So I've used that. Needle felting is one of the fastest growing crafts at the moment. It's the most popular craft. Kids absolutely love it, even though they stab themselves frequently. They get over. I've a lovely little student. I teach homeschoolers, and I had a group of them a couple of weeks ago, and one of them was just so cute. She kept coming up to me, and she said to me, "Can I have a blaster?" And I went, "What? Oh, a plaster? No, you call them band-aids, we call them plasters, right?" She said, "Can I have a blaster?" And I went, "What's a blaster?" So, oh, she's so cute, you know. She said, "I stabbed myself, can I have a blaster?" And I went, "Okay, yeah, plaster." So, but they just get on with it, you know. So you kind of, but we've had, you can do little scenes, you can do little mushrooms, you can do little animals. I've made toys for my son, my youngest child, and little angry birds, you know, little key rings, all that kind of thing. It's brilliant for making little toys for children. And also when my son was smaller, he had this little, what's that thing where you fire? I'll think of it now. My brain is gone.
Like a Nerf gun?
No, the slingshot. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. A slingshot, mm-hmm. Right? Tiny little slingshot. And rather than, well, obviously we weren't going to let him shoot stones with the slingshot. So I made these little felted balls so he could shoot the felted balls. And, you know, the tiny little things, and they're not going to damage anything, but they're brilliant. You know, right? So you can do a lot with it. Like, so those are the two different types of felting, and you can combine them, and when you combine them you have so much possibility. You know, you can do landscapes with just needle felting. That's quite straightforward, but because I was primarily a wet felter, I like to do the wet felting ones, and you can do bigger versions. You can do very, very large pictures with wet felting and just add detail then with needle felting. So
I've learned something. I thought that the whole needle process was to puff it up, but it's really more to combine fibers and add in colors then.
Yeah. So needle felting is just sort of, it's a dry version of wet felting, but you can, the techniques suit the making of different things better, if you know what I mean. Like, you wouldn't needle felt a scarf because that would just be too time consuming. You'd be there for 10 days, you know. So
right.
You could, you know, depends on what you pick. Some things just work really, really well with needle felting, you know, like adding grasses. If you add a piece of, you get a sheep's lock. And when I say a lock, I mean, you know, like a lock of hair, a lock from a sheep. You've got the outer edge, which is the bit that you see, and then you've got the bit that's stuck into the sheep. And you can just needle felt one end of that and just leave the rest of it loose, you know. And if you try to do that with wet felting, you wouldn't really be able to. You'd have to spot wet felt it. You'd have to sort of go, I'm holding this bit out and keeping it dry, and I'm wetting this other bit. So, you know, the needle felting allows you to I suppose to be able to pinpoint certain areas you know, and to add bits and add texture. And also the needle felting, as you were saying, the you can actually puff things up with the felting needle, in that if you have, say, you put in a landscape and you have a mountain, and then you want to put a field wall in front of it or something, you could take your needle and turn your work sideways and actually poke the needle in sideways, and that helps you build up the texture of your field wall, and you can actually lift it up a little bit off of the back, you know. So it's a bit like taking a stick, you know, picking a stick and poking it in and pushing something forward, you know. So you can do that with your felting needle. So the felting needle to me is, as I said, it's like a fine brush, or it's like a little, you know, a little stick that you can kind of move something over here and just tack it down a little bit, and move something over here and tack it down a bit, you know. And so it's just a very helpful tool on top. Saying after that, then I do the embroidery. That would be the next stage in the pictures. I'd add the embroidery.
How did you come to be doing needle felt art, or felted art like this? What was the path? Did you start with more conventional embroidery and needlework and then find this, or how did this come to be your focus?
It was interesting, because I took a class in wet felting, nearly 20 years ago, and I just completely fell in love with it. And I went, oh my God, I can't believe this thing exists, you know. So, but we were learning how to make hats and bags and, you know, things to wear, accessories and brooches and that kind of thing. So I just went crazy on that for a long time. I could make two or three hats a day, you know. I just really loved it, really dropped myself into it. My kids were quite small at the time, and then it was, I suppose, it wasn't a business for me then. It was a hobby. It was something I was at home with the kids, so it was something to distract me, I suppose, just, you know, do something creative as well at the same time. And but I did too much of it, and I got tendonitis in both my arms.
Right.
Because, you know, these things are an obsession. We don't know how to pace ourselves, right?
Right. I totally understand.
Yeah, you see, I make four hats a day. Why not make four hats a day? So, and then I had my youngest child was quite small, and I was carrying him around as well, because he was a toddler or whatever. So I just couldn't keep going. I couldn't do the rolling and of the wet felting. So I took a detour, and we had moved into a new house at the time as well, so I started kind of decorating the house, and I did a little bit of decoupage. I met someone who's a really good friend of mine now. She was doing furniture painting. It was all the rage at the time, so we taught each other how to do stuff, and then we started teaching classes in it. So that went on for about a year and a half, and then I went, oh my God, I really miss felting. I really miss the wool so much, that one day I was in Kerry visiting my parents, and there is actually a woolen mills. This is the Kerry Woolen Mills, which are a very famous brand in Ireland, and they produce scarves and hats and things, and they send them all over the world. And that woolen mills, luckily, happens to be sort of within, you know, 30 minutes drive from my parents' house. So we went up there and found that they actually had the raw, that, well, they had dyed wool, the stuff that they use themselves to spin. They do the whole process there except for the washing, and they have all these different colored wool fibers there. So I bought two huge bags of it. Like, I just came home like Santa, you know, with my bag. And then we started making pictures. I started making needle felt pictures. So I looked up I'd seen things on the internet. I said, this is really lovely. I wonder how they do this. And I just got a bit of cotton batting. And then I just started putting the wool down, and I had some yarns. My mum had loads of knitting yarns left over, so I used a bit of those, and I just needle felted all these things in and made these tiny little so postcard size needle felted pictures. And I was enthralled with them. I mean, when I look back now, I look at them and go, they're very simple. But I was just, I was in love with them. And I was looking at it, and I was sewing things on. I was sewing these little wool neps, they call them, the bits that are, there's these hard bits that you get on the fleeces that are already felted. And they're like little balls, and you can sew them on and as texture. So I was making little poppies out of them. And I just loved it, absolutely. And then my arms healed a bit, and I went, I'm going to do this in wet felting. So then I started working bigger. You know, I went back to doing the bigger pictures. I was laying out the fibers as if it was a painting from start to finish. And, you know, I was gridding it up. I was actually treating it completely like a painting. So I would have a piece of this, what is called pre-felt. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Pre-felt, it's a piece of sheet of felt which is only brought halfway on that needle felting machine, which means that you can still wet felt into it. So it's really handy. You put it down and it's like a sheet of fabric canvas, you know, and then you just add your fibers in, like you put your sky in, your blues and your whatever, and then you just work down with your mountains and whatever you need. And you just keep going all the way to the front. And then what I do is I make it bigger and bigger and bigger and higher as it gets to the front, so that you almost feel like you can walk into the scene, you know. And then, as I said, yeah, I was able to wet felt those then. And that went very well for a while until my arms started hurting again. So then I bought a wet felting roller. The gentle roller. I don't know if you've heard of the gentle roller. It's actually this is an Australian company, and I got the first one in Ireland because I was looking at it going, that is pretty cool, because I make a lot of small pictures and I needle felt the detail on top of them. So I made huge sheets of wet felted fabric, and I would then cut them up and dye them various different colors. And then I would take them, cut them into postcard size, and then either do a little bit of a stitch on it, like a little flower, like a dandelion or something, and then a little bit of needle felting and a bit of embroidery on them. And these were my small little pictures. And I made a lot of those. You can make seahorses and loads of different things, all these small ones. So I got that, the gentle roller. And it was the game changer, actually, because it was just huge pieces. I could make a meter by a meter and not have to roll it myself. You know, this machine does it for you. So you still have to do the laying out and moving it around and changing direction and stuff. But also what was really helpful is that I had a few students who had injuries and you know, weaknesses in their arms. Some people had a couple of people who had MS, and, you know, they had injuries, back injuries, shoulder injuries. So I was able to teach these and say, listen, you just do the fun bits and then we'll put it onto the roller and let the roller do the hard work. So that was really helpful. It meant that I could bring lots of other people into my classes that had to miss them, because wet felting is quite labor intensive.
Yeah,
you know, so yeah, so that was kind of how I did that, you know.
Yeah, and how satisfying because you know what, so someone with a disability now can, because the tactileness of the fiber arts is so wonderful, but if you've got that disability where you can't do part of it, it's kind of frustrating.
Exactly. Like, I mean, if you were teaching somebody for 2 hours and they were laying out the wool for 1 hour, and then they spent the next hour rolling the felt to get it to, rolling the wool to get it to felt. I mean, they don't need to learn how to do that, because it's just rolling something backwards and forwards. And you can say, you know, if you didn't have the gentle roller over there, you could just do this by hand. But we do, so you don't have to. you know, so I show them the techniques, but then we take the shortcuts, yeah. You know, and right. Yeah, because, you know, you get value for money as well. Do you know, when you're teaching people, you don't want them to be just going away. I said, but I made this flat piece and it took me an hour to actually roll it, you know, right. So so it's good that way. You get a lot done.
Now, a lot of your art is Irish landscapes, which reinforces the fact that I have Ireland near the top of my list of places to visit. Just gorgeous landscapes and so much texture and depth to them. Do you start with reference photos, or do you just make those up out of your mind or from driving around collecting wool?
Well, all of that, actually. So I trained as an archaeologist originally in University College Dublin, and I have a very strong connection to the land. And my family, my dad is English, and my mum is from Kerry, so we grew up in Kerry, and the landscape has been, some of the land that my mother is near has been in our family for at least 250 years. Mm. Now, a lot of the land is falling into the sea, which are coastal erosion. It's yeah. not, you know, it's bogland, it's up the side of a mountain, but it's incredibly scenic. It's very near, you know, the Star Wars movie that they filmed in Ireland, the Skelligs.
Yes.
If you've seen Star Wars, the Skelligs, you know, that rock that comes out, that rock is coming out of the water where, what's his name? Luke Skywalker, where he was.
Right.
That's actually yes. in Kerry. That's off the coast oh. of where I'm from.
Oh. Yeah.
So, yeah. And it is the site of a Christian monastery. So an original Christian monastery. So those huts you see in that movie are actually real.
I thought that was just made up stuff. Oh, man.
No, some of them will be made up, but they are actually there and they're 1,000 years old.
Wow.
So, so Kerry and a lot of the west coast of Ireland and most of Ireland has a lot of archaeology. And the archaeology we have is Bronze Age, Neolithic. So you're going back 5,000 years or even more. Now, a lot of it we can't see because the bogs grew up over a lot of it. So, you know, but in the area where I'm from, there are stone forts, ring forts, stone alignments, which is one stone lined up with another one. There are standing stones. There is so much Bronze Age activity in that area. And I mean, I was just fascinated, absolutely fascinated with that, trying to figure out what were they doing. And but when you climb some of the mountains in where my parents are from, in Kells, it's Kells, County Kerry. It's when you climb some of those mountains, it's panoramic. You know, you can see something amazing from every angle. And you can see all the way out to the Skelligs. You can see other mountains, the other islands and things like that. So you can see why ancient people would have been living there.
Yeah.
So for me, I just have this love and connection to the past, and I'm very interested in living archaeology, which is almost imagining the sounds and sights and smells that somebody was experiencing as well. You know, it's not just about the you know, the ruins that we find. It's about the people that lived there. What did they wear? Where did they get their clothes? Did they dye their clothes? Did they use wool? What did they do? You know, people are very clever. They always find ways around things. So, you know, there's ingenuity and innovation. So that's always going on in the back of my mind. So I always always felt very connected to Kerry, to the landscape. And I would literally be standing in a field doing surveys and doing archaeological digs and things like that. So to me, it just feels right. It's almost like when I'm doing a landscape, I'm recreating the landscape physically. and my emotions towards the landscape. So it's quite different than if I was, I can paint and I do like painting, but the reason why I prefer the fibers is because you can touch them. Mm. You know, you can feel them.
Yes.
You know, there's no distance between you and your raw materials. Your hands are right in there. And, you know, I play with silks. I throw them up in the air and I just look at them and look at the way they land, you know. So it's all about, it's a very big experience for me doing all this. It really lights my fire, you
right.
know. You know, it's a passion. So I suppose that's really the background. And when I was doing archaeology, I actually wanted to do art. So I kept taking steps away from archaeology, away from digs, to actually more towards the drawing side of it. Because art was always in my head that I wanted to, you know, I really wanted to do it. So every time I did something, I kind of took a step towards doing something that ended up being artistic or, you know, representing stuff. And as I said, I think wool was the medium for me, you know. Wool was, I think, with everybody has something that will just go, oh, my God,
yeah.
This makes me so excited. And you really have to try so many things until you find the one or two or whatever, because I know a lot of people, we were doing craft groups and craft classes, and then some people would come in, and I've heard this so many times, they'd say, I'm useless to art, I'm not very crafty. And I go, yeah, you think that because you haven't tried loads of different things. So years ago, I used to run this one craft group, and every month we would do something completely different. We were painting on silk, we were making clocks, we were everything. It was mosaics one week, there was candle making, there was soap making, there was random. And you get some people that had never done something before, and they were just incredible. And they'd be looking at it themselves going, I didn't know I could do that. And that's a gift to be able to give that to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think for me, the teaching is like that as well. You know, you've got so many people and they're kind of down on themselves, you know. So when you give them a new list, give them a new language. So I think it's very important.
Yeah. The other part about your work is it's not just all wool, that you incorporate with machine embroidery and all manner of things to enhance the images.
Yes.
That comes after you're done with the wool, or is it just an integral part of building up the piece?
It depends on the piece. And this sounds very, what's the word? Sounds very corny, but I let the piece speak to me. In that, you know, if I look at something, usually with something that has water in it, I like the glint of beads in water, you know, or metallic threads. Because, you know, if you're looking at water, sometimes you get that effect, which you can't quite do with the wool, you know, because the wool is matte. So adding these extra bits in, like the machine embroidery, is helpful for outlines. So I usually use the machine embroidery, go up at the top of a mountain, outline some fields, field walls, maybe put in a few bits of grasses and things like that. And then the bigger bits of embroidery, you can put in larger stems. And then the beading is, it doesn't suit all the pictures, but it suits some things like underwater scenes. You know, really like they're like little bubbles in the water, or, you know, as I said, water, maybe it's water I use them for. Usually beads are in my pictures of water. I hadn't thought about that before, but that kind of makes sense now. And, or you can, depends on what beads you have, you know, you can use these green seed beads and you can make your stems out of them. What I do encourage people is to look at their own stash, is to go home and to look at their own stash and say, what do you have? Do you have paper? Do you have buttons? Do you have beads? Do you have ribbons? What do you have? Take them all out, rip them apart if you need to, do whatever you want to make them into something that you can put in a picture. I like using wire, so I sometimes put grasses in as wires. I just stick wires in and just sew them down. And that will be something I kind of enjoy doing, and beading wires as well. So for me, the stash of craft materials that you own reflects you and your style. So that's why I always push the students towards their own stash, so they can do a picture with me, but then I go, what do you have that you want to incorporate? Or do you have something that's belonged to a loved one that you want to put into this picture? You know, so they're supposed to reflect the person that's doing them.
So do you use like silk then, or silk hankies when you're doing your needle felting?
Do you know Yeah, so I would use any silk. I have loads of different types of silk. I imported some from India at one point. So I have a few different types of silk. This is raw silk, some of it. So I have silk fibers and silk threads, and I have the throwster's waste. I have silk nets, and I have silk hankies. The hankies are a little bit awkward because you really they stick to your hands when you're trying to, when you're trying to take them apart, they're kind of, But right. I would use them, and I would use silk fabric as well, you know, because you do this Nuna felting where the wool travels through the silk. So you can put pieces of silk down into your work as well, and that'll give another kind of an atmosphere, you know, a background. You'll have so I would do that, maybe hand-dyed silk or some random. So I keep certain bits, you know, whites, and because I would still make the odd scarf. So I keep some silk and I would maybe dye some bits, and I would drop them in and things like that. But I suppose most of it is incorporated at the wet felting stage, if it's the silks. I don't tend to add silks after that stage,
okay,
because silks don't work really well with needle felting. Because if you try to needle felt silk, it puts it in a straight line. It's really difficult to needle felt silk fibers. So, it kind of makes things look mechanical, whereas you want them more organic, you know? So,
right.
Yeah. So there's different stages that you'd use different materials, I think.
The stash you must have built up over the years has got to be pretty
frightening. Oh, my God. It is actually frightening. Somebody said to me the other day, because I had a shop recently which I closed, but I had two huge boxes of commercial fibers which I was selling in the shop. And there's a guy, and he looked at them and he said to me, "Oh, I suppose it's because you were closing the shop down." I said, "I wish I could blame the shop." But I really can't, you know. But every year I do go into my studio and I go, "You weren't used, you weren't used, you weren't used. I don't want you anymore." Do you know? So I do tend to go, "Nah," you know, because I like my stash, but I like a organized workspace. You know, yeah, I want a tidy desk. Or else I can't work if I don't have a tidy desk.
Yeah, see, that's interesting. Some artists have to have it neat and tidy, and others just pile it up and I'll find a way to make it work. Yeah.
No, I need to have it kind of, what I tell people is, when I'm doing a picture, I will actually set myself up to succeed. And I was watching videos on YouTube and there's this fantastic guy that does this colour in your life. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's in Australia, called Graham Stevenson. And he went around to loads of different people and he did this 20-minute video on all these different art, loads of different types of artists. and some of them were painters and things like that. And I was looking at them and I was going, why have I in my head? Why do I think I'm cheating if I organize myself? You know, I kind of go, oh, as an artist, you should be able to just do this. You know, you shouldn't have to, you know, do a drawing first or plan it out or use a grid. And I was going, what? Who put that in your head? You know? But these are the things we say to ourselves, you know, we go, oh, you're not a real artist if you can't just draw it off the top of your head. And I'm going, oh my God, I thought about that for so many years. And then, so what I do if I'm doing the picture is, as you say, I would, the photographs you were asking me about earlier, I take a load of my own photographs and use them, and I would blow the photograph up in the photocopier, A4 size. I would put a grid on my A4 picture, and then I would take that grid and I would have my pre-felt on my mat, and I would transfer that grid to my mat, maybe double size. I might make it double size. So I double all my measurements in my grid on my A4 picture, and I put the grid onto my page, and then I would box by box by box put in my landscape. Because I am not trained enough to be able to do that freehand. Yeah. Now I can do some freehand, but for the bigger ones there's distortion. If you don't do it with the grid, there's distortion. It's very easy to get distorted. So I would do that, and I would plan it, and that would make it so much easier, so much easier. And, you know, I felt guilty about doing that for ages, thinking, why? And then watching a lot of those videos from that Australian series, and I was going, oh my God, real artists actually do this. And I was going, woohoo! You know, why not?
Right. And I think you say something important. It's setting yourself up for success. I think we're like, well, if I don't do it, if I'm not free forming it, then maybe I'm not really an artist. But you're saying no, you know, set yourself up so that it works for you.
Exactly. Use all the skills that you have amassed, and use extra skills. Take skills from other people. You know, there was one guy I saw, and it was really, I was looking at him going, that's crazy, but that works. He was a painter, but he set his own photographs up. So he created the scene, got himself and his wife into the picture, all dressed up in whatever clothes they were supposed to be using for his ultimate painting, took the photos with proper lighting, and then used that photograph to do his painting. And I was thinking, that is brilliant.
Yes.
Do you know? Yes. Make it easy for yourself.
Right.
You know? So so that's what I would say to people. We're all trying to, do we all find ways of battering ourselves, you know, and saying that's not good enough and you didn't do that right and whatever. And I think you have to demystify a load of the processes for people and just say, this is how I do it, you know, and I tell my students about the wall. You know, when you hit the wall and you look at your art and you go, that's rubbish. And that happens to me every single time I do a picture. Every time. But I'm so used to it, I go, oh, there it is again. That wall. And I just go, go away, wall. You know, I'm not listening, you know. But every time I look at some stage, I look at my picture and go, oh my God, look at the state of that. That's just, oh, what am I doing? You know, every flipping time. And then I go, just trust the process, trust the process. Okay, do your needle felting, then do your embroidery, then do your other embroidery, and then go back over it, and then have a look, and then stand it up somewhere 12 feet away, because that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
12 feet away and look at it, or photograph it, which is a really good way of seeing the mistakes, and then come back to it, you know, in a few days' time. And I said, this is, and take the emotion out of it. Take the emotion out. Don't put the emotion in there, because, you know, not supposed to be judging yourself. You're supposed to be just creating. But like, it's taken me 20 years to actually talk myself down. And I know lots of people go through the exact same thing.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Yep. Help us out. Needlework. All of us needleworkers hate this question. How long does it take? But we also, because we know how many hours go into a sampler, yes, or a needlepoint piece or an embroidery piece, are these pieces of art that you create, do they fall into that basic time frame? And I know it always depends on how detailed and how much you want to put in, but they're not something you just pop together in a couple of days. They take...
No. And some people put, when they look at them, they go, oh, why can't I do that? And I go, well, you know, 20 years and at least 30 hours, you know, and sometimes maybe if I sat there and for 4 days and didn't go anywhere, I could probably do it all in one go, but nobody can, you know, so I just break things down quite easily and I'll say, right, I'll lay out these fibers. I'll do the grid. I'll lay out these fibers a bit. I'll come back in next day, lay out a few more fibers. You know, I don't put myself under that pressure to get it done, and just kind of bit by bit by bit. So if I was to estimate how long one piece would take, and you're looking at maybe, say if it was, I did one piece that was 3 feet by 2 feet. It's a quite large piece. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I would say that took me about 39, 40 hours, you know, which is fair enough, like, because you're laying out of fibers could take you 4 hours.
Yeah.
Because you lay out as many as you possibly can. Your wet felting is going to take you a bit, you know, if you don't have a gentle roller, and then you would add in the needle felting and all that, and then the hand embroidery and the sewing and all other, you know, every single stage, and then you have to trim it all down, and then you have to put a backing on it to hide all your ugly stitching. So, you know.
Right.
Exactly.
So do you more than one piece at a time? Do you have more than one piece going, or do you like to focus on one at a time?
So if they're commissioned pieces, they're one at a time. So because they're so detailed and they're like having an oil painting on the go. So those ones, they're one at a time. The ones where I can make one big, huge sheet of felt, that I can do numerous those. I mean, I can be in watching the TV on a winter's evening and I can do 4 or 5 of those, because I've already got the backgrounds wet felted and dyed, and I just need to do a little bit of sewing on them, you know, so I could do loads of those. So, but the big ones I would do, one at a time, because, it's hard to, you shouldn't let yourself do anything else either, because I get distracted. I'll do anything other than a commission sometimes, because it's in my head and I'm going, oh my God, what if they don't like it? What if they don't like it? Oh, look at this. I think I'll go over and tidy this. Oh, look at this.
It's time to go clean the bathrooms.
Oh,
yes. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. God, the amount of housework you get done when you're avoiding the commission.
Right. Totally understand.
It's amazing. So, you know, if you ever want to do your housework, take on a commission, because that's the best thing. But that's the way I would do it. Well, the dyeing thing I haven't mentioned. I don't know if you wanted to ask me about the dyeing.
Oh yes.
Method. I can quickly just tell you how I do that with the fibers and the backgrounds. I would use Jacquard acid dyes. They're silk and wool dyes, and they're for animal fibers. So I have used those consistently because they give me good results, and they're intense colors and they're color fast. And that's why I would use them, because the colors don't fade. And so I would I don't mix them with water. I usually use them in powder form. So if I was making a bit of if I was dyeing wool fiber, I would put that into a saucepan, put a bit of vinegar in, maybe half a cup of vinegar, and you can control the amount of water that you put in the dye pot. And because I don't like having a single color, I like loads of different shades and colors, because that really helps in the pictures. So if I was doing a green for shrubbery or grasses and things, I will put in yellow first, a bit of yellow, and just drop the powder in randomly, let it soak a little bit, put in maybe a chartreuse green or something on top of that, maybe put in an olive green, and I would move the fibers around. So constantly the fibers are all getting different colors. They're absorbing the colors at different rates. So you're constantly getting different shades and different colors and different shades of the different colors. So that way, when you're finished, you have to leave it, I suppose, simmer for about 20 minutes. So I usually just leave it sit there until the, even take it off the heat and let it sit there, and it absorbs all the dye. And then you'll see that you have this multiple coloured stuff, which looks much more natural than one single colour commercial yarn. You know, you can't get the same effects with a single colour. So that's what I would do with the fibres. With backgrounds, if I wet felt a background, I do them in, I drop powder, different coloured powders, onto the fabric, the felt fabric, put a bit of, I think you call it saran wrap or cling film, we call it, on top, roll it up and tie it and drop it into hot water with vinegar. And so the powder dyes disperse slowly in a kind of controlled way. And because of the cling film and the saran wrap on the fabric, it stops the colours from all blending together all of a sudden and becoming a dark muddy brown. So the colours will just disperse slowly. So it's really, really a good way of getting a multiple colour background, which is how I make my little backgrounds. And that they come out really well that way. It's a bit of a surprise, you know?
Right, right. So you don't measure the amount of dye you put in a pot. You just kind of guess. Okay. Yeah. No. I was watching you, and first of all, you didn't wear a mask, and I was just like horrified. I was like, oh, please put a mask on. Sure.
Oh, yeah. With the powders.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So right. Usually when I'm doing that, I would be doing next to a window. But that time when they were doing that video, it was raining outside. Oh, yeah. Right. So we had to close all the doors. So, yeah, so the powders, so I would drop the powders in like that. Yeah, but you should, people do use masks for them. And right. I don't mix them, though, because if you mix them with water, then you have less control.
Right. Right.
You know, they just go everywhere. Yeah.
Right. Right. I was just curious, because so you don't use the same formula every time. You just just kind of sprinkle some in. I love the way you dye. That's fabulous.
Yeah. Thanks. It's just it's intuitive, because I just kind of look in and I go, that didn't quite go in the way I wanted. It's not the right green, or it's not light enough. So I go back and add another color. So I keep changing it depending on what I want it to be. And so you can kind of, I mean, to me, doing the dyeing process is probably equivalent to some people smoking a cigarette, right? And I don't smoke. So I go out and I want a craft fix. I go with a dye wool, because I'm standing there looking at it going, oh my God, this is so cool. This is so good. You know, and nobody understands what I'm doing. I'm kind of looking there going, well, look at that color. And that goes over there. And that color is going over here. And then what I'll do then, as some of it is absorbed, and I know that the color is there's not an awful lot of color left, but there is some, I put in more wool because then I get more colors on a different piece of wool.
Mm.
So especially for the sea, if I was doing blues, you know, you know the way the sea has got low, if a wave curls, you've got loads of different shades of greens and the viridian and turquoise and stuff like that. And so you kind of need that in your wave if you're going to do a picture. So that's why I'd be very aware of doing that. I always drop something else in, maybe at the last minute or something, and I'll go, it can take the remains of whatever dye is left in the pot, you know. And even threads, sometimes I'll drop white threads in as well. So right. Just constantly creating more stash. Basically.
I know what you mean, because I normally dye cotton fabric, and right. There's something about it when you're like, well, you know, I really don't need any, but it's instant gratification. You pull it out of the dye pots and you rinse it, and then you like, and I don't normally iron anything except for my dyed fabric, and I'm ironing it and I'm yes. like, oh, look how gorgeous yeah. this is. What can I do with this piece of fabric?
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, mm-hmm. we sound very similar, because I was ironing a background onto a commission piece I did the other day, and my husband was there, and he goes, oh, you've got the iron out. And I goes, no, I haven't. You're imagining it. I said, you're imagining it. No.
We don't iron clothes. That's crazy talk. Nothing. We only iron.
Yeah, you saw nothing. Walk away.
This iron is only for fabric. It doesn't touch clothing. Exactly. It just, you know,
this,
it doesn't.
This iron, it might wreck your clothes. You wouldn't want to use this iron on your clothes.
No, horrors.
Oh, yeah. All right, we got to stop, Sharon. This has been so much fun. Oh, what a great world you live in.
We could go all day. That's the problem.
Yeah, we Fantastic. Have to stop. Thanks so much for doing this. Really enjoyed it.
Well, me too. Thank you. Thanks a million. And I am a chatterbox, so you can feel free to cut out most of that.
No,
it'll be great.
Yeah, and thanks to everyone for listening.